Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Negotiation Podcast. And today I am pleased to be joined by Leif Rogers and Gino Gordon of Red Phoenix Entertainment, a sports marketing agency facilitating the expansion of North American sports, athletes, and franchises into Asian markets. Leif, the founder and CEO, alongside Gino, Chief Strategy Officer, shared their unique insights and experiences in bridging sports cultures across continents. The conversation further explores the popularity of North American sports in China, with Leif providing analysis on Chinese viewership trends, including interest in events like the Super Bowl and the particular appeal of various sports and athletes. Gino, who previously played professional American football in Japan, contrasts these insights by discussing the sports landscape in Japan, noting the differences and similarities with China. He also shares his perspective on the Shohei Ohtani phenomenon and the broader implications for sports marketing and athlete endorsements. Leif discusses the intricacies of international sports sponsorships, exemplified by the partnership between Linglong Tire and the Tampa Bay Lightning, delving into hockey's growing popularity in China. He reflects on the NHL's past engagement in China and offers strategic advice for future endeavors, emphasizing the potential missed opportunities and advocating for a more aggressive re-entry into the Chinese market. Together, Leif and Gino highlight notable campaigns and the commercial prospects surrounding the upcoming Summer Olympics. They conclude the podcast with a compelling argument for why Western sports entities and athletes should consider Asia as a fertile ground for growth, underlining the vast opportunities awaiting in this dynamic market. Enjoy.
Since we last talked, Todd, the sports landscape has evolved. The younger demographic is a lot smarter. They dive deeper. I don't want to generalize, but in the past, it was just, oh, whatever team was number one was okay, that's who we're the fan of. And there wasn't as much heart or just kind of knowledge of the game in it. And that Adrian Peterson trip was a classic example. NFL is an emerging sport over there. The NFL has been there, I think, 17 years. They've never played a game there. But you do have a fan base, and they're very passionate about it. And flag football seems to be doing very well there. And it's definitely an emerging sport. But there were kids that were introduced to Adrian that knew more about the NFL than all three of us combined.
Home to over 4 billion people, the Asia-Pacific region boasts one of the most powerful consumer markets on the planet. Not only is it home to half of the world's under 30 population, but it's also home to more than half the world's internet users. It's a market that no globally minded organization should ignore. But entering markets like China, Japan, or Southeast Asia is no easy task. Just ask the likes of Microsoft, Google, Uber, and Facebook. However, times are changing, and with the right partners, doors are slowly opening as more and more companies find success growing their key markets in APAC. I myself spent 8 years in China, mostly as a venture capitalist, helping early-stage tech companies grow in the Asia-Pacific market successfully. This show is dedicated to uncovering and examining successful Asia market entry and growth strategies by interviewing the experts who've done it before and truly understand what it takes to be successful in the region. My name is Todd Embley, and welcome to the Negotiation, brought to you by WPIC Marketing and Technologies.
Leif, Gino, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Todd. Appreciate bringing us back for this.
You betcha. Gino, welcome to the show.
Todd, thank you so much. I'm really excited to talk about, you know, the things that we're doing at Red Phoenix. And again, thank you for taking out the time.
Yeah, it's super exciting for anybody into sports. You guys are kind of living the dream, to be honest, even though you're probably exhausted and don't feel like it's a dream or that you're so tired you're living in a dream. Gino, where in the world are we recording you from today?
I'm currently in Tokyo, Japan, where I've been living for the past 10, 11 years now.
Okay, cool. Leif, where are you today?
I'm home. Gino just flew back to Japan. We just did 10 or 11 days, Boston, Brooklyn, LA, and I'm home in Philadelphia today. And then tomorrow I leave for Hong Kong, Macau, Shenzhen.
Right. Okay. But not a Phillies fan, a Mariners fan, though. Still?
Yes. Right? Oh, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Obviously. I mean, really, Phillies? So let's start today. Leif, going to come to you first. Thanks for coming back on the show, old friend. Can you give the listeners an overview of Red Phoenix, how and why, you know, you founded the firm and the kind of work that Red Phoenix does?
Yeah, no, I moved home from China in 2016, kind of fell into it. I worked in banking in China, and there was a financial firm that sponsored the Rockets. And we were in Houston at the time, and he asked me to help him out with the sponsorship and to serve as his representative. And I quickly realized he'd massively overpaid, and he only was getting about 5% of the benefit of even just local city sponsors were getting. And that kind of frustrated me. And it wasn't anything nefarious. It was just the two sides. One side didn't even know all these different aspects of a sponsorship even existed. And the Rockets didn't realize somebody overseas would even want these different aspects. And so that was how I fell into it. And at the table were some of the biggest brands in the world, you know, your Alibaba's, your Tencent's, and everything else. And that was, I think, when we last talked, Todd. And since that time, we were kind of one hit wonders with the NBA and only China, and a series of events, including Daryl Morey's tweet, was very costly to us. But we were already expanding out into different sports, different in different areas. And one of those was Japan. And that's how I actually met Gino, was bringing over an NFL player to Tokyo, Adrian Peterson. And he was on the other side for a huge camp with about 1,000 kids coordinating all of it. And I said, oh, I want to know who that guy is. And that's why Gino's with me today.
It wasn't just because he had a cup of coffee with the Seahawks?
No. No.
Okay. Just making sure for those who haven't gleaned. Leif's a Seattle fan. He's a Seattle guy. So that's where his allegiances lie. But Gino, you may have some other allegiances because you were a professional football player. You came out of Harvard, you played in Japan, and now eventually landing at Red Phoenix. Can you give us a little bit of your story, your background, and how you ended up in China, or how you ended up in Asia?
Oh, of course. My relationship with Asia actually started prior to I was being born. So I was actually born in Sasebo, Japan. My father was in the military and my mom's is from the Tokyo area. So I was born there. I ended up staying in Japan till about age 3. And then we moved to San Diego, where I ended up growing up. And so I very much had a multicultural background where Japan and America, I was in between. I was able to really just figure out or, you know, try to understand what it was like to be American and Japanese at the same time. So that's always been a part of my life. And sports was really that connector through all of that. And I ended up playing multiple sports, but football was the thing that I ended up playing from age 6 to college. So I played at Harvard, had a decent career there. It's all Ivy League, three years in a row, Ivy League Player of the Year, Harvard Player of the Year. So I had a pretty good career there. And it didn't end up making the NFL, but what I did do was find an opportunity to play in Japan, where there's a corporate league that's been around for 35 years. You know, we can talk about this later, but American football has been in Japan since the 1940s. So it has a long, long history there. And I was able to play for about 5 years and had another great experience where we won a couple national championships, won MVP of the league and stuff like that. And then from there, worked as a consultant at a Japan entry firm, basically acting as the in-between Japanese corporations and international startups to help them enter the market. And then finally, where I met Leif at that camp, he told me what he did. And I realized, like, this is what I want to do. You know, being able to connect American sports into the Asia region was something where I felt like it was a match made in heaven. And from that moment on, it's been Leif and I, you know, taking on the world. So it's been a great experience.
Cool. I got a quick question for you. I've had a few family members in hockey get very close to the NHL, not quite make it, including my brother. He played pro for a few years, but they have all said that, there's this almost indecipherable, very, very infinitesimal difference sometimes between those who make it and those who don't. Would you be able to put into a few small words why you feel you didn't make it to that level when some others do?
Well, I mean, there's obviously a lot of factors because each NFL team has only 53 people on roster, probably two practice squads. So it's just a matter. And if you think about athleticism or what you do on the field, everybody, you know, for the most part, it's pretty much indiscernible. So a lot of it has to, I won't say it's political, but a lot of it is being able to talk to the coach and say, hey, you know, take a chance on me. And no offense to Harvard football. I think it's a great history and stuff like that, but you're just not from a big school.
Yeah.
And your priorities,
not a big football school.
No, not a big football school at all. So my priorities lied in academics, and sports was a passion of mine, but I knew that I wasn't going to be, you know, a pro bowler, like I wasn't set to be a pro bowler. So, even though I tried my hardest, I think people in the end of the day just realized that like I had other options. And when you have other options, you know, you're not going to get that extra chance. So I would agree with what everybody says, that there is a very, very thin line between those who make it and those who don't make it. It's really just being lucky enough to get the opportunity.
When you have other options versus you're up against the guy who has no other options, does that mean something?
I think that's the one, that's the beautiful thing about sports. And when you're in it, like, especially with football, like it's who wants it more, right? And not to say that I didn't want it more or less than anybody else, but that if you have a plan B in the back of your mind, I feel like, and even on the image of things, when people like look at you and say, all right, well, this guy has other things that he can do. You know, people would rather take a chance on a guy that said, all right, this is the only thing he's going to do and he's going to get it done. So I do believe that that there is something to that. But you know, in the end of the day, football is my love. You know, that was the thing that I always wanted to do. And I was lucky enough to find an opportunity in another country, which took me a completely different route. So it was one of those things where, you know, like I did have other options and I prepared in that way to have those options, and whether it hurt me or not, it's kind of, you know, doesn't really matter at that point, because sports was my love and it still is now. So
it makes sense because, you know, Mark Cuban, famous investor in a lot of different stuff, has said that he, at least he said at one point, he would never invest in a company that had an exit plan in their pitch deck, because he didn't want them to even be thinking about plan B or an exit strategy. He wanted them completely focused on winning, and that was it. And I don't know, that kind of ties in to kind of what you're saying there. So, okay, thanks for indulging me on that.
No problem.
Leif, this is a big topic. I mean, we're talking about North American sports into Asia in general, right? How would you assess the popularity of different North American sports in China? For example, obviously the Super Bowl happened. We had the Swift effect. You know, did you ever notice something the Chinese people were turning into? And then, you know, after that broader assessment of the major North American sports and their attractiveness or the attention that they're garnering in that area of the world, which sports and athletes are really particularly popular right now?
Yeah, I think since we last talked, Todd, the sports landscape has evolved, which has been a great thing. They're getting just the younger demographic is a lot smarter. They dive deeper. I mean, I don't want to generalize, but in the past, it was just, oh, whatever team was number one was okay, that's who we're the fan of. And there wasn't as much heart or just kind of knowledge of the game in it. And I'm seeing that, especially with the younger demographic, where, and that Adrian Peterson trip was a classic example of it. That pulled, you know, NFL is an emerging sport over there. The NFL has been there, I think, 16 years, 17 years. They've never played a game there. But you do have a fan base, and they're very passionate about it. And flag football seems to be doing very well there. And it's definitely an emerging sport. But there were kids that were introduced to Adrian that knew more about the NFL than all three of us combined. And these were like 21-year-old kids. And that was a real touching moment where they're talking about his Oklahoma plays and a play he did. And I'm like, wow, how have you even seen this? So I'd say what I'm seeing across Asia, and you saw it in the Olympics with Tokyo taking the title in skateboarding, is that they're a lot more diversified. Before it was just kind of soccer. And then in China, it was NBA, but pretty much everything else was just on the wayside. And I don't know, Gino, I know I'd like to hear your commentary on Japan, but like, I guess there's lacrosse is growing like crazy in southern China, and rugby is taking off over there. And you're just seeing, and we're in Korea, we're in Taiwan, we're in Hong Kong. We've been doing a lot of work in the Philippines. And so maybe it's the impact of all those countries and all their different loves of sports is I'm getting this feeling. But even in China alone, I mean, I've had multiple conversations about mountain biking and skateboarding and you know, these endurance runs where you're running 24 hours. And that's been a real cool thing to witness. It's really evolving across the board in sports over there.
Okay, let me stay with you, Leif, just for one more second, because I want to see what your take is historically leading up to now. Why does it feel like sports has been such a big part of life in North America such a big part of life in Europe. Why hasn't, in your opinion, and we'll, you know, obviously just your opinion, why do you think, and I'll put it this way, positively, why do you think sports has so much room to run in Asia, given that it seems to be at its infancy in so many sports that have such a long history in other areas of the world?
Yeah, that's a real good point. And again, I'm never want to generalize, but I think it's that for a lot of your Asian cultures, they've never had time to do any sport. It was only about studying. And you know this, Todd, that, you know, at middle school, they're putting in 12, 14 hour days, and who knows, in high school. And there was no time to play sport. And then you had, in some countries, where you were chosen as a 4 or 5 year old to be a volleyball player, or whatever it was, just because your height or you had the look, and the rest of them weren't even considered. And it was just an afterthought. And I think that Asia has realized that, you know, we need to get healthy, one, and two, it's very good for our kids to be playing in these sports. And it's good, not just physically, but good for, you know, teamwork, camaraderie, you know, challenging, and also to help them in our international world, help them when they go study abroad. And I think that's a big component of it. I heard that's why lacrosse is so big, is because they know that it's popular in the Ivy League schools, and it's something that they've got the build for. And so I think you're seeing just a general, people want to be healthier. You remember the city I lived in, Jinzhou. I mean, this is tier 3 city. And, you know, I've got friends that probably smoke 3 packs a day that are now out mountain biking. And it's spreading across everywhere. And I think in Japan and Korea, too.
Gino, I'll come over to you. And I want to give you a stat first before you comment on that. 16 million young people graduated from high school in China last year. No, 8 million. I think it's 8 million. 8 million graduates in high school from China last year. 16 kids got into Harvard last year of 8 million graduates. And I think there's a booming business in academic enrollment opportunities in Asia because their applications are too one-dimensional, put it that way. But yeah, Gino, if you could just maybe touch on that, kind of how we got to this point of there kind of being a bit of a dearth of athletic focus or sports focus in Asia.
Yeah, there's one thing I actually wanted to touch on, especially when it comes to kind of entry into like Ivy Leagues or top tier schools, because I had the same question too, and I get asked this all the time in Japan. It's like, well, why do some people get in, some people don't, especially with someone with a higher GPA or something like that? I think there is a lower limit, or there is a basic standard of like, I won't say intelligence, but grade, GPA, all those things. There is a limit standard that you need to meet. There are other aspects that are also being taken into account when you're applying for these type of schools. A few of them, and I don't know if this happens in every school, but like I went through 2 or 3 different interviews with alumni to see if I was a cultural fit, my leadership capabilities and stuff like that. So it's not just, oh, like, do you have all these type of extra, like, do you have all the grades and the test scores? There's a whole other aspect that a lot of these schools look at, because one thing I know I've seen this at Harvard, I've heard it taught multiple times. They said that we're not creating or we're not educating the next just smart people. We're educating the leaders of the world. So and what do you think about leadership? It's not just, oh, are they the smartest person in the room? It's like, do they have the qualities to be able to get someone to do something else? So like, that's why I feel like sports is a natural avenue to be able to develop those type of soft skills, whether it be like cooperation among peers, being able to be persistent in failure. And I read an interesting stat, I think it was on LinkedIn, but it's like, I think 15 of the past 21 presidents of the United States was an athlete or did sports in their youth. And that just kind of just goes to show like American culture, athleticism, being able to kind of be that kind of in front leader is something that is valued in American culture. And that's one of the reasons why I feel like it has a huge space, or at least mind space, within the US. And I just don't think that's necessarily the case in Asia. But that's basically what I think about.
You're right. Yeah. It's a leadership hack.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. 100%. To be able to be a leader, you can, you know, if you're a captain of your football team, It's easier. There's an easier transition for you to be a leader of whatever company. And that's why I feel like there's a clear synergy between business people and sports athletes. That's why there's so much love in between the two, because a lot of people who are successful in sports can be successful in business.
Yeah. I mean, that's why in my house, I am head of sanitary department. and my wife has nominated me that, and I've earned it. Because of my prowess in sports. To the question of the history of sports in Asia, what are your thoughts?
I can speak a lot to Japan on this because I've nerded out a little bit. There's a couple things to consider with sports, especially in Japan. It was considered more of, it's separate. It's not, it's actually kind of separate to in society, where it's similar to more like military, kind of the military aspect, developing the body and mind. And that's why it didn't really make its way into commercialization or any of those type of, they're kind of separated. I feel like that's one of the reasons why in Japan, it's kind of going through a rebirth, almost like a renewal of the way sports is seen. You know, in America now, obviously we talked about leadership qualities and developing the person, but it's also hugely, it's considered entertainment, right? Sports is entertainment in the United States. I don't think that's necessarily the case in the Asia region. And obviously, kind of Leif touched on this as well, Japan is very much the case, where sports is an entertainment. It's kind of like a feat to show how well, you know, how athletic these people are, or it's like a way to kind of show these type of messages that promote Japanese culture. But I'm seeing right now that people are changing the conversation, saying, hey, sports is entertainment. Sports is hospitality. And that's why I feel like we're kind of in the precipice of a rebirth, or at least a renewal, and kind of renewal of interest in sports. And I'm seeing this all over the place in Japan for sure.
Now, I want to talk a little bit, and I want to stay on Japan, and maybe Gino, I'll stay with you a little bit. Mm-hmm. There is almost no greater example, I think, of what an individual can simply do for a sport in one country. With all due respect to Tiger Woods, Yao Ming was an unbelievable, not only an ambassador, but just driver of the interest in basketball in China. And these, but you know, and it's interesting because I'm heading towards talking about Ohtani, and it has been incredible. I'm very happy to say that he is on my fantasy baseball team, and I am very unhappy to say that he's not a part of the Toronto Blue Jays. It's just I want to just like, what is the impact somebody like Ohtani, who's from Japan, for those who don't know who we're talking about, he's potentially the greatest player to ever play the sport of baseball or any sport in general, the way he's dominated on both sides of both pitching and hitting. But he, with Anaheim, signed with the Dodgers. He's just absolutely massive. What does that do for a sport like baseball in Japan? And I will kind of asterisk that just slightly, knowing that baseball was already kind of, you know, it is huge in Japan and Taiwan and whatnot already. But what has Ohtani done for baseball in Asia in general?
Oh, I mean, I think he is kind of the lightning rod to making baseball relevant for the young people. So I 100% agree. Baseball is one of the top sports, or was considered the most popular sport in Japan. But at that point, like prior to Ohtani really doing what he did, it was wavering. You saw that, you know, soccer kind of becoming more the popular sport, people watching Japan's soccer team do well. And you saw basketball doing really well. If you look at kind of the numbers on it right now, basketball is one of the sports that's being played among the youth the most in Japan. So Ohtani made baseball cool for the young people. And I think that's something to really consider, because even you kind of see this in the States as well. You know, how do you get to the Gen Zers or the young millennials or whatever generations under them? How do you get to them? And I feel like Ohtani was kind of the reason why it's cool. And I think that cool and also international. So one thing, when you have Ohtani playing in Los Angeles, you have more, you know, just based on what we do, you have way more Japanese companies saying, well, how do we sponsor the Angels, or how do we sponsor the Dodgers, which really wasn't in the conversation prior to Ohtani coming. So you're seeing two things. A, greater interest on the young population of Japan, and then greater interest from on a commercial aspect for commercial partnerships with Japanese corporations who generally look domestic for their commercial promotion, now looking towards these international properties like the Dodgers and Angels and stuff like that. So I think it's just adding, he's adding, you know, more to the globalization of sports.
Yes, absolutely. You know, and we kind of briefly discussed before we started recording Eileen Gu and, you know, what she's been able to do for the sport. Leif, coming over to you, and both of you could comment on this. I am curious about the brutality of some sports versus others. Okay. Gino played football. We've all seen a couple of movies that come out, deal with concussions. And we know that sports like football, American football, and hockey are particularly physical, and that there are genetically some physical differences between different areas of the world. Some places have genetic gifts that other places do not for certain things, whether it's long distance running or whether it's, I don't know, rowing, what have you. So this is a very, I don't know if it's a bit of a hot button topic in a way. We'd be slightly careful we talk about it, but I think it is something to explore, because I don't know if this is part of the, you know, brutality or the physicalness is part of the cultural makeup in all areas of Asia. Like, we have sumo wrestling in Japan, but it is not brutal. It just looks a little bit, you know, where does MMA and the growth and popularity of MMA or MMA gyms growth kind of land on the spectrum? Is there any data that even shows up on the radar when it comes to Asia, that kind of thing? So I guess my question is in and around that, Leif, what are your thoughts on growing sports that are more physical and seem from the outside or to the viewer to be a little bit more brutal to growing ones that are not?
Yeah, I think, that argument swings both ways. I mean, I know because I've talked to NFL China a lot, and that there was a reluctance of the parents to get involved into a sport that is just, from their eyes, from seeing it on TV, is absolutely brutal. However, I'd rather the NFL would talk about this. They can say it much more eloquently. I witnessed it that they switched more to at the peewee level to flag and kind of ease them in, and only the top students, and they were all in their 14, 15, hitting that age group, were starting to put pads on and everything, because by then the parents were not only completely comfortable with the sport, but just diehard fans. And you're seeing Chinese American players that have come over here. One of them's our intern right now, Paul, up in, what school is he at in Rochester, Gino? Yeah, I've got him. He's playing, I think, defensive lineman or something up there. And so I think they're fully capable. I don't think it's a hindrance at all. They just haven't had the opportunity, and they were steered towards different sports, whether it be basketball or, you know, whatever, tennis or whatever it was that was ping pong or that was considered more normal there. But we're seeing it a lot. But then you've got the NBA aspect that, you know, I've heard it from multiple NBA players, you can't teach height. And so the height is definitely, I think, a problem for bringing more Asians from over to here to that break into even G League or NBA. You haven't seen many since, and I think Joe Chi was the last one to really make a major league roster, NBA roster. I believe, Gino, you've had a couple of Japanese players over here playing in the NBA. One of them plays now for Oklahoma. And so, but usually it's guards. And so that, on the genetic side, I mean, that's maybe something that can be controlled. But I think for the most part, it's just they just haven't had the opportunity to play the rough sports. And as you know, Todd, you're from Canada. I mean, I cringe. I went to a couple professional games here in Philadelphia. Lacrosse is brutal. Oh. I mean, it makes hockey, like, you know, looking like they're figure skating out there. It's hardcore. And then when I heard that was taking off in China, I was just shocked. But again,
well, rugby. You mentioned rugby.
Yeah. Rugby in Japan. Look at Gino. Yeah. They went from like nothing to being now one of the top rugby nations in the world, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's because of multiple reasons and why you could develop a property like football or rugby or something like that, or American football, excuse me. Rugby is a really creating heroes, because again, going back to kind of that entertainment thing, is like we have to a lot of times what people are doing, or what is the fast pass to making any country love that sport, is creating the hero representing that nation and them challenging into whatever sport that may be, right? So like you talked about Rui Hachimura or Watanabe doing stuff in the NBA, that helped NBA skyrocket in popularity. And that's basically what happened with rugby, when the rugby national squad did really, really well in the Rugby World Cup, and I think it was 2019 in Tokyo. And again, one thing about Japan is that, a lot of the professional teams are obviously popular, but the most popular teams are the national teams. So like Japan's basketball, soccer, rugby, all their squads are hugely popular, because for them, being able to kind of challenge the world is something within Japanese culture, and it's still really, really strong. So creating heroes and creating the pathway to success or pathway to pros is extremely important. And then finally creating the grassroots, what Leif talked about. So basically having that top end kind of area, where can they get to create the dream, and on the bottom create like the functionality, saying, all right, well, you, if you want to get here, this is how you do it. Creating academies, creating opportunities to meet these type of heroes, and then finally opportunities to play. So, you got to start from the bottom and the top as well.
Okay. I'll kind of sit on that as mostly debunked as a theory, and we'll see how that plays out. Let's talk a little bit of hockey, and not just because I'm Canadian, but you guys have done some work before, Leif. I know there's been something you guys did years ago with the Tampa Bay Lightning and whatnot. I have a feeling that hockey is something that I think can really take off in Asia. I think that. I just feel like they can do really, really well. They can really think the game. It's about quickness. It's about hand eye, for coordination and stuff like this. And I think we can start to see that they're getting well past the financial barriers, because that's one of the biggest things with hockey is just the cost of maintaining a sheet of ice inside a building. And then getting the access to it just makes it a cost prohibitive thing to be able to try, right? And we talked about that awareness and being able to try something, right? Yeah, I mean, soccer, 100%. Basketball, man, with a small footprint, you just need some concrete net. Like, yeah, everybody can kind of get out there, do it. Even football, right? American football, you could get out there, do that. Rugby, things like that. Baseball, but sandlot, right? Hockey is just simply got a same with skiing. There's a cost prohibitive nature to that. But tell us a little bit about what you're seeing in hockey in Asia.
Whew. So we've had a pandemic, and I've been to China. I went once in 2022 or twice in 22. And then I went a lot every month in 23, and multiple spots in Asia. And I feel, honestly, that hockey really peaked when the Winter Olympics ended, and I'm not hearing it talked about as much. And just for the very aspect that you're saying is the lack of ice rinks, especially in cities that aren't tier one, wherever that is. But to that point, the ones that are involved in the sport that I've met, and I've met some in Japan as well, they're the most passionate hockey players I've ever met. So I think, yeah, you've answered your own question. If they had the availability and the ice rinks, and I don't think the cost of the, everybody always brings up the cost of equipment as a hurdle. And yeah, okay, for sure. But I don't think it's that big of a hurdle. I think it's the lack of places to play that I see in Asia.
Is it in marketing, it's always, can I see myself as the person who's telling me I need this thing, right? Or if I'm in a house, right? Do I see myself in this house, which is why whoever's selling should take down all the pictures of their family and their dog and stuff like that, right? It's just, you have to be able to envision yourself as that person. And so, you know, this does seem geared maybe a little bit towards a bit of a marketing problem. It's just that we don't have somebody that we can put in front of, you know, people in Vietnam to say, this is you, and this could be you. You could truly see it now. They just don't have that.
Yeah, I 100% agree. Like, you know, it's actually something that you see with all the other sports. They have someone that they can kind of live up to. But if you can't do that, I feel like another obvious choice, or another choice that we espouse upon, is really getting whatever sport it is in front of the people you want to grow at. So it's one thing Leif and I talk about is like being NBA has obviously gone to China multiple times. They've gone to Japan multiple times. And when you invest time and effort into engaging with the potential fan base and the fluid fan base, you're able to really, you know, gather more popularity. And then you have to be kind of the cooler talk, be a part of like the cooler talk in these regions in order for you to really gain popularity. So there is that, you know, if you can have someone that looks like them to be there, but if not, bring the sport to them. And I think for NHL, that's kind of the next step for them. If you can't actually have, you know, these matches, because obviously the inlay to be able to build that might be difficult, then why don't you, you know, do some type of like retired legends tour? You know, Leif and I have done that multiple times with the NFL. We did something with Jamal Williams, who's the starting running back or one of the running backs for the New Orleans Saints. We had him, you know, we filmed 4 days in Tokyo, and he's a huge anime fan, so we were able to create some really, really interesting fan engagement activations. And then, you know, we all took content of that, and then the NFL used it, put it on their social media, and got millions of views, and got really, you know, gained a lot of popularity within Japan itself. And I think that's the next step, is how do you engage with people on the ground and digitally? If you can do those two things, you can create a following for sure.
Yeah, and I'd like to add to that, Todd. There's a big difference from just showing up and actually engaging with the country. And take that NFL example, the NBA players we've brought over, I mean, it's something that we take pride in, that we're doing the same types of events that they do in other parts of the world, but it is specific to that country in a cultural basis. And just showing up, and I feel the NHL, you know, that had China games for many years, but they were just showing up. It was kind of being marketed lightly, and there wasn't a lot of effort put into it. And consequently, you ended up having an arena filled with expats all from Canada and Eastern Europe and Scandinavia. And conversely, you have, you know, the NBA and now the NFL is making a huge push internationally, where they're going into a country and engaging with that particular country. And some leagues are better than others, and some teams are much better than others. And we as Red Phoenix will tend to navigate towards the teams that we know are going to do their best abroad, and because it only benefits us. And so it's funny. I mean, we get called by NBA teams all the time. And, you know, if they're not willing to engage, you know, they all want the dollars and they all want the fan base. But if they're not willing to engage in that fan base, we'll turn to a team that does.
They have been attempting, as you said, the NFL is really pushing hard into that area of the world. Just briefly, are they trying to grow the sport, or are they just trying to grow the economics that come from the sport in that area of the world?
I would say that they're trying to grow the sport and the fan base, but that leads to economics for the sport as well. So they're playing the long game and they're doing it wisely. In some countries, I do feel that they dip their toes in it just because it looks sexy, and other countries they invest more into. And I think that's just, you know, the price of business and just knowing that they can activate in a country easier, and you've got security and all these other elements to it as well. But the NFL, they were kind of the last to the international game, if you look at it. Yeah, baseball, you have this massive influx of players coming from South America, North America. Hockey, huge. It was internationalized by itself, not necessarily because of the league. Then the whole NBA thing, and NFL had their little Europe thing, but they weren't really going to the rest of the parts of the world. And now we see it every day. I mean, they're in Africa, they're hitting Asia, they use us for Japan. And what I like about the NFL is they're very methodical and strategic, and they're not just running out trying to get, hoping that, you know, they're going to get billions of dollars in sponsorship by next year by doing this move. It's the long game for them.
Okay. So And right. And all these sports we're talking about are almost as good as hockey. What are the mistakes that have been made in the past about trying to grow sports that Red Phoenix has recognized and is either doing better or doing differently in order to grow sports from the work that you two are doing?
I'm going to answer first, and then Gino, I'd like your side, because Gino handles a lot in Japan, which is a somewhat one of the tougher countries, I would say, to do it in. So we actually got it from feedback from the players that we, when Red Phoenix was first formed and we were bringing over active NBA stars over to Asia, we purposely will do it when they're on their shoe apparel deal trip. So, for example, take any player, they're flying over, they hit Tokyo, they're doing their Adidas show, then they go to Seoul, and they go to Beijing, and then they go down to Manila, and then they even go on to Paris and everywhere else. And they're doing these same cookie cutter events for Nike or whoever it is. And that's fine. They work great and whatever. But when they'd hit Shanghai, we would dovetail and do our event the next day or the day before. And again, we put a cultural element into it that where it's a real engagement with these fans and it's a real engagement with the brand or whoever that is, and manage both those sides so that you're eliminating the nonsense, but making it impactful where, you know, that where the fans or whoever's involved in this are walking away with a much better experience than being walled off and that just, you know, it's this 1 hour show that's done in every city across the world. And the players really resonated with that. And another thing that we do is oftentimes use iconic cultural touch points, whether that's the food or the a site or a market or whatever that is, and have the players engage there. And this is something that they never got to experience. So they're happier. They're doing more. The fan base, the brand, whoever that is, they're a lot more touched because, oh, they're in our country and they're experiencing what we're proud of as a nation. And it just, it works well. And then I would have to say execution is key. And Gino and I run an extremely tight ship. And knowing that if anything goes haywire or there's ever, especially a cultural mishap, we're done. And so it's something that both Gino and I are very careful about, but what we've done and the content we've produced, you can see it in the players and the fans or the brand's eyes, how happy.
I mean, Leif kind of hit the nail on the head there, but I think Leif's absolutely right. Just the cultural approach and being able to say, instead of saying, hey, let's monetize now, which is, you know, we hear it quite a bit because there's such a large market. It's just being able to have a more localized approach to how we do business. I obviously played football in Japan, and then I did business in Japan with Japanese corporations. I know that there's a clear difference between how Americans and Japanese do business. And I know with Leif, talking to Leif, there's a clear difference between how Japanese and Chinese do business. And just having that awareness when we're thinking about commercial partnerships, saying, hey, like, I understand this is not how sponsorship sales goes in Japan or in China. This is how, you know, we try to localize as best as possible. And we have that same DNA in everything we do when it comes to activations or selling commercial partnerships or doing any type of campaigns. So that's the main thing. And the second thing is really being focused on the goal at hand, which is developing the sport. I think people always look for like the low hanging fruit and trying to grab whatever they can now. We have a long-term approach and saying, hey, if you really want to be able to create a fan base here, you have to have a long-term approach, at least a medium to long-term approach, and then the dollars will come. And we always have that conversation, and it's a regular conversation we have with every single property, I think. But if you're able to kind of have a long tail approach, you can, you know, the world is really your oyster in Asia. And all three of us probably understand this. Asia is going to be the hotbed for sports, in my opinion, whether it be tech, investment, you know, sports tech, all that kind of stuff, consumerism, it's all going to be in Asia. And it's just who's willing to play the long game to be able to really get everybody in the space.
I want to ask a couple more questions. So you mentioned not making any kind of cultural missteps. And this wasn't really a cultural misstep. This was just a messy situation in Hong Kong. And I'm just curious about what your thoughts were about the fact that how many people were upset, bought tickets, bought jerseys, the whole thing. They show up in Hong Kong. Miami shows up in Hong Kong and Messi doesn't play. I had a bit of a debate with Leif. What's his name? That again, the guy that we
Mark Dreyer.
Yeah, he and I saw differently. We had opposing views on this. So for those of you who listen to the Mark Dreyer episode, you know that he and I did not see kind of the messy situation and what went down the exact same way. What were your thoughts? Should people have a right to be upset? Do you think? And I know that there was a contract that said Messi either had to play like 0 or 45 minutes or some other things. There were some details that weren't always fully public knowledge, but how does stuff like that play out when you're trying to do something like bring a team and grow a sport in a particular place like Hong Kong?
Yeah, and I wish I knew. Gino and I are fully aware of it, but Gino and I have been traveling nonstop since that happened. So I haven't really jumped into all the details of, you know, I read why it happened and I've certainly heard from our Hong Kong team how angry people were. And I listened to Beckham's talk about it. But I tend to, on this situation, we've been around so many professional athletes and the pressure that they face on a constant basis. And we did a lot of work with La Liga and David Villa and Iker Casillas, and they're retired and they're still on a plane every single day. And I feel soccer stars or football stars, I mean, they're pretty much playing year round. Your top ones get a couple weeks off, maybe around Christmas or and they're just the commitments are overwhelming. And so I tend to lean on the player's side on this. I don't know why maybe he just didn't come out. I mean, but to have it, if he wasn't feeling it, I mean, how old is Messi? If he wasn't feeling it and couldn't play and he was like trying to prevent a hamstring injury or whatever it was before he was going in the season, all power to him. But I don't know the particulars of like, if he didn't show up at all, or, you know, maybe he went out and partied for all I know.
Managing an injury, I think they held him out, but they didn't say anything.
Yeah.
It just happened. He never showed up on the field. And then people afterwards were obviously very upset. And then they tried to walk it back. And to me, it was the way it was handled. I got no problem sitting the guy out. If he's, you know, he goes out, he starts kicking around, managing that, got up on the wrong side of the bed, had an ache or a pain. This is, you know, it's like 10 minutes in Hong Kong, or do I want to play the full 45 next stop in Tokyo? I don't know. But they made the decision. I just don't know if it was handled that well. But I won't press you guys anymore on that because I know that you weren't heavily involved with that or able to kind of digest a lot of that. So I'll move past that. I want to kind of open this up a little bit for you guys to flex a little bit and tell us a little, you know, some of the interesting campaigns and some of the work that you guys are working on, some of the stuff you're working on that's coming up soon.
Yeah, I mean, I think one that I was most excited about that we did beginning of last year, it was in alignment with trying to promote the basketball, the FIBA World Cup. And it was held in part of it, at least part of it was held in Okinawa, which is like a tropical city down south of Japan. And they built a brand new arena and they were trying to figure out ways to A, boost tourism, B, get more interest and get people interested in coming to Okinawa, because it is a tourist destination post, even outside of FIBA World Cup.
It's also a blue zone. They were,
yeah. Yes, it is. Actually, that is, it is actually a blue zone as well. So some of the, I think one of some of the most hundred-year-old
centurion,
excuse me. It's a wonderful place. I've been there a few times. But yeah, they wanted to turn into a tourist attraction because it's hugely popular locally, but internationally, it's actually quite strategically located for you know, different countries. So they wanted to promote that a little bit more. And what we set up for them was basically a promotional tour where we had Rip Hamilton and Mo Evans, both, you know, NBA legends who spent, you know, 5+, 10+ years in the NBA. We had them come to Okinawa and we filmed for about 4 days again and had them film in the arena doing different things. We filmed them doing cultural events and activities specifically to Okinawa and then trying the Okinawan food and then created content and then also a lookbook to promote tourism in Okinawa City specifically prior. And then they used the content, which got them probably the most, got their platform the most views they've ever actually gotten ever. So it was a huge success. FIBA World Cup was a success over there as well. And I feel like we did at least a little bit, a little part to help promote it.
Yeah, we're seeing a lot, Todd, of in the past, it was always, we had to have the brand in Asia that, you know, they wanted to endorse the player and we arranged all of that. And we've been so, you know, successful that now agencies and players themselves turn to come to us and say, hey, I want you to help build my brand over in China or Japan or wherever that is. And we organize that trip out for the agency, and Gino's getting ready for one in March or May with a Kansas City Chief player. And we'll hit different dynamics. So we'll take something that they love, whether that's food or fashion or whatever it is, and make that a major focus of the trip. And then fan engagement, camps, that kind of pillar. And then the third pillar is more PR and interviews and just building their brand over there, meeting with corporations, et cetera. And one of the players that we brought, Whitney Merciless, was defensive end legend for the, he was a defensive end, right, Gino?
Yep.
Yeah. And for the Houston Texans, played with JJ Watt, and his whole one was a food component. And so we went to a 400-year-old restaurant in Kyoto, and the cooks taught him how to make a dish. And then we went to a sushi market in Osaka and at 3 a.m. where they were auctioning off the tuna fish. And it was actually an ex-running back, a Japanese player, came over to America and made it into the arena leagues. He now runs a big sushi operation. And he was sitting there teaching Whitney how to cut the fish, how to identify the fish. And, you know, the television stations all covered it and went viral over there. That's the fun stuff that we do. I really enjoy doing that. And it touches both sides. And now I think Whitney's gone back and forth 2 or 3 times and to Japan. So he's continuing to build his brand over.
I've been waiting a long time. I've got an idea to pitch to you, Leif. I think this is going to be big. Okay. Forget Gatorade. Forget BioSteel. Okay. What we need plastered on all the water bottles on all the sidelines, Mao Tai water bottles.
Yeah.
I think this is a winner. This is an absolute, you know, you get Pat Holmes, you know, sitting there, Mao Tai water. It'd be amazing.
As Mao Tai is the number one stock in China, I think that's going to be a pretty expensive partnership. But
yeah.
I don't know if you heard about the Lucan coffee collaboration with
Mao Tai. Oh, the Lucan? Yeah.
Yeah. And completely went ballistic. And that's another thing that we're seeing that's a really cool trend with brands is that, obviously, influencer marketing is huge in Asia. It's starting, you know, it's big in the US as well, but I feel like they're light years ahead there. Well, the brands are starting to try to, rather than just repeating the same type of influencer, the same type of campaign, they're starting to collaborate and focus on different demographics. And this one group we met in Hong Kong, they represent a bunch of luxury brands, and they were super, interested in sports because it targets a 30 to 50 year old male demographic that are likely to be buying the purses and buying this high-end luxury wear. And so the collaboration that they explained to me was where, you know, the guy watching TV, he's watching soccer or whatever it is on a domestic channel, but there's a scan he scans. If he takes that in, he gets a free, like, I don't know fashion, Louis Vuitton little mini purse with the brand of his team on that purse. Yeah. And then he gives that as a gift because it's a one of a kind to his wife. And now she already bought Louis Vuitton, but now she wants even more. Now the husband is familiar with the brand. And I thought that was genius. And we're starting to see the Luckin Coffee, Mao Tai, these different collaborations that I think pre-pandemic you would never have heard of.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, none of this can't be any worse than the Dunkin' Donuts thing. For those who haven't seen those commercials, go check them out. They're kind of funny, but I think they miss, unfortunately. And I don't think it's Tom Brady or Matt Damon's fault either. I hate to say it. Okay, thanks very much, guys. Last thing. It's just huge. I just think that this is the place in the world where sports is going to grow the fastest for the longest amount of time. I think if you're looking to get in, now's the time. Beat the rush, beat the line. Talk to me about commercial opportunities maybe surrounding the upcoming Summer Olympics, and just the broader selling pitch on why professional sports entity or textiles makers or academies or athletes should be looking for growth in Asia. Start with Leif.
Well, I'll answer, and then Gino, I'd like you to answer your thoughts too. But just the fact that of the, I think the 20 highest GDP economies in the world, 12 of them are in Asia. And so I think Asia should be a focus for everybody. And with regards to the Olympics, the one thing North Americans, I feel, miss the boat is just how powerful and popular Olympic sports are across the globe. I mean, it's got that Super Bowl feel. It's got that World Series feel, and it pulls out fans and all age groups that I don't think know anything about sports. And so it's super powerful. And for brands out there, Olympians are wonderful to deal with. They're, you know, they don't get a lot of opportunities. And when they do get an opportunity, it's just during that Olympic time, and then everybody fades away. And we did a campaign for a Japanese brand where we went through a lot of Olympian athletes and then narrowed it down to four. And it was one of the most rewarding experiences of my life. We picked the youngest American athlete, the oldest American athlete, a female athlete, and then a Special Olympics athlete. And I'm still in touch with them these days. And the most important thing is this was a major brand, but it was a small budget. And we not only accomplished everything that they wanted. Again, it was their best marketing campaign they'd ever had across the globe. And that was just for one video. And we did 16 of these different videos. But more importantly, the price point was 1/1000th of what they would pay for any major sport in the world. And so it was a very cost-effective approach and super timely and super hot. And so I really, getting to know all these Olympians, God, I wish North America would jump on the bandwagon to support these athletes more, because our North American athletes need it more than they do, because a lot of these countries, they're supplemented by the country itself, whereas in America, they're just kind of, yeah, we'll pay for your ticket.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, I mean, path of least resistance. Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's super noisy where we are, but in places where you don't have to compete with the Super Bowl and you have the Olympic opportunity that comes up that does take all the oxygen in the room, huge opportunity there. Right. Gino, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd touch on like the overall opportunity in Asia. I mean, I think Leif did a great job talking about the Olympics. If you don't mind, I'll talk about Asia and kind of the three areas as to why I feel like it's going to be the hotbed, or why it's secretly is already, but you need to be able to invest into it a little bit more. And within the next 10 years, it's going to be the place to be. I think the first thing really is consumer activity, right? If you look at advertising spend for the top five countries. Obviously, the USA is number one, but if you look at number two, three, it's Japan and China. So if you're looking at where marketing dollars are going or where marketing dollars are being spent, China and Japan are right there. So you're seeing a lot of opportunity for sports to be able to, if you're talking about commercial partnerships, which is usually through marketing, you're seeing there's a lot of opportunity there that's just not really being accessed, or it's only being accessed locally. If you're looking at Fortune 500 companies, there's 210. Again, you have some of the largest, you're talking about GDP, some of the largest economies in the world are China, Japan. I mean, Japan's not fourth, but China, Japan, India, South Korea, they're all in that one strategic area. And if you have an Asia strategy to be able to access each of these markets, you're accessing the next gold mine, right? The last two, and one is the younger population. Obviously, we did talk about the aging population for Japan and China, but if you're still looking at Southeast Asia and those different areas, you're still seeing like almost 60% of the young people in the world are still in this area. So they're all digitally savvy. They're able to really, they're globalized. So you're seeing a lot of young people whose appetite is open to global properties or American properties like sport, like NFL and NBA and stuff like that. And finally, investment, right? If you're looking at by 2026 or something like that, sports tech or the sports industry in Asia will be the largest in the world. That's what's expected to be. So you're seeing all the stars aligning at this point in time. Even if you look at all the kind of underlying issues of these economies, you're seeing that, okay, there's a large middle class that's willing to spend, that's digitally engaged and globally focused. that is literally the recipe for success for any type of property. So you just got to get in the game now and do the work. And that's kind of how I feel about the situation. I feel like there's a huge opportunity, and if you can really, really invest into it, you're going for gold. Really.
Yeah, I think it's that's the thing. It's not going to be cheap, and it's not going to be easy. But oh my gosh, is it going to be worth it? You just have to have the cojones to hang in there, and it will eventually absolutely pay off. It's just going to take some hard work. All right. Thanks very much. Leif, buddy, thank you very much. CEO and chief, founder and CEO of Red Phoenix. And of course, to Gina Gordon, Chief Strategy Officer for Red Phoenix. Thank you both very much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Okay. For those of you listening to us audio only on Spotify or Google Podcasts or Apple Podcasts, please don't forget that we have the video full version, and you can see all three of us on the full length YouTube video or on the YouTube shorts over at the WPIC YouTube channel. But for me, for Leif, for Gino, and for everybody at The Negotiation, thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Growing a company is hard. Doing it in a foreign market, exponentially so. The best piece of advice I can give you is not to do it alone. When you start looking at the Asia-Pacific region for further expansion possibilities, and I sincerely hope you do, make sure you choose the right partners to do it with. My good friends at WPIC Marketing and Technologies have almost 20 years of experience helping brands, just like yours, enter China, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Negotiation, and if you're interested in being a guest or want to connect with me or any of our team, please reach out to us at podcast@wpic.co, and be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.